The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
This is Mike Consul. Thank you for joining the program. We're going to be discussing retail evolution, as it has been called by the CCIM Institute. KC Conway is going to be my guest. He makes no bones about it that he really dislikes the retail apocalypse reference that you see in the media all the time, because there is no apocalypse going on. He says there's an evolution or an evolution in retail. Things are changing, and the organization for which Casey Conway is chief economist makes five predictions about where we're headed to 2025. And I must say, I was looking forward to this discussion, but it was far more interesting than I even thought it would be. Very content-rich in terms of retail concepts and also the data that Casey Conway shares with us. So, without further pomp and circumstance, my conversation with Casey Conway.
I'm not a fan of the term retail apocalypse, because it connotes that everything's dying and going away and terrible in retail, and that's not the case. Consumer spending is growing and is continued to grow all post the recession. And so I think, retail has been evolving, since the ancient seaport days and the first time the first caveman kicked caveman out and said, I've got cabin fever, let's go to a market and meet some people. So I think evolution is a better terminology than apocalypse, because I don't think retail is dying, it's just changing.
In that report that you guys just did, you came up with five different predictions. I want to kind of walk through each of these. And the first one I have written down here has to do with online retail sales. What are we looking at? Now, you were just saying it's not going away. We'll get to traditional, but the online retail sales, what's the outlook there? What's the prediction on that?
Yeah, so, today we're only about 10% of our total retail sales that are online, so that's a small number compared to all of the retail bankruptcies and store closings. I mean, you would assume from the headlines that, 9 out of 10 things are bought online, and that's not the case. And we're seeing, as the technology advances, as last mile delivery is kind of figured out, that we're seeing the online activity of retail grow from, Amazon tackled books and music, and then 2 years ago bought Whole Foods to do grocery, and we see it morphing into everything, whether it's online grocery sales, whether it's online casual dining, whether it's auto dealerships. And so our prediction is we really have not scratched the surface on the growth in online retail activity. And so the challenge is going to be figuring out how to make it profitable, how to make the margins work, and how to make all the logistics pieces come together. So our prediction is, if you just use the old finance rule of 72 and divide 72 by what you think your growth rate is in online, and you use the conservative 10% growth rate number, which we think is a lot more than that, it would tell us that we're 7 years away from that doubling. So every divide 72 by 10, that tells you how many years it takes to double what you're doing. So our prediction was by 2025, we should be easily looking at 20% of all of our retail activity being online. And I think that's a very conservative statement, that we'll probably see it be more like 25 or 30%.
Now, I heard you say casual dining.
Yep.
Online, in what way? Can you explain that, Casey?
So, it's a nice way of saying fast food. It's like you can't say mobile home parks anymore. You put a different term. So casual dining, a lot of it is your fast food. So look at McDonald's has taken one path with self-service kiosks, which are a disaster. They haven't worked very well at all. Chick-fil-A is probably the Amazon of casual dining. They've already developed their apps. They're developing sophisticated additional drive-throughs, so people that do online go through a different drive-through category to pick up and get through quicker. So we're seeing increasingly, we're a society that wants everything immediately on the go. The kitchen is probably the next thing to not be built in a home, because we eat out so much or buy prepared meals. So we're seeing it, grow tremendously. The model of using Uber Eats, to take a $6 meal from McDonald's and deliver it at home isn't going to long range be profitable. But how do the fast food or casual dining restaurants also tap into the potential of online? we think Chick-fil-A is probably the leader in that, and McDonald's is probably in the needs most improvement category. But it's a huge growth area.
Interesting. So you also talk in the paper about redefining brick and mortar. How does it, the people who are in the business of building shopping centers, lifestyle malls, what have you, what is it that your research is saying that they need to be paying attention to in terms of redefining brick and mortar?
Yeah, so the first, I guess there's a couple of things to unpack in that. So the first is, I hate the term experiential retail, because again, retail's always been about the experience. You know, whether, you know, I'm 57, I grew up in, you know, where you'd go to the mall because you couldn't get a long enough extension cord on your phone at home to have a private conversation. So the mall was your experience as a teenager to get away from mom and dad. But it's always been experiential. And I think what we need to think today, what's happening with retail, is retail's growth is going to be in alignment with services. So services like hospitality or travel and airports and medical campuses. And so I think when investors and owners of retail are thinking about what do we do with retail, how do we repurpose it, where do we build it, it's going to be more part of something rather than standalone. So, you know, I think the term big box is going to be replaced by, you know, maybe something that Starbucks is doing. It's going to be grande or aligned with services. So Starbucks just took over in Chicago the iconic Crate and Barrel store on Michigan Avenue. That was a 40,000 square foot store with a really iconic facade. And Starbucks took it over, and they're opening it with their new roastery concept that has everything going on. It's got co-working, it's got entertainment, it's got restaurants, it's got a manufacturing kind of museum to see how the beans are roasted. But I'll give you a couple good examples of what I'm talking about, the aligning with services. The one we profiled in retail prediction number two was retail popping up or aligning with hospitality. So hospitality has kind of had a good run, but it's meeting some headwinds on how much more it can increase its revenue and its rates and occupancy. They're already at pretty historic high levels. So how do they continue to improve margins? They got to pack more into the store or into the hotel or cut costs. Retail's looking at how to physically cut occupancy costs, but at the same time, really tapping into where that consumer is. And so we're seeing retail come into hospitality. We're seeing retail develop loyalty programs that align with hospitality, much like the airlines did. We're seeing retail and concepts like restoration hardware go into hotels and museums. We're seeing there's a really good concept called Great Wolf Lodge that started up in Minnesota and has worked its way down through the middle part of the country to Colorado, Georgia, North Carolina. And they're kind of a hotel with a water park, but they're also well-located business hotels. And what they've done is they've brought the retail into the hotel so they don't have to staff it, fixture it, and operate it. So they brought in Build-A-Bear stores and Disney stores and Chick-fil-A and Dunkin' Donuts. And so between registration and the water park or the amenities is all this retail. So the hotel doesn't have to absorb the cost of all of that. And they get a take of the top, revenue, maybe, 15% of it. So they get all these services, they get a take on the revenue, and they have none of the expense. That's a pretty good deal. The retailer,
so this is ground floor retail you're talking about in hotels?
It is, yeah.
And then it's a hotel that's owned by the, investors or owner of the hotel, and then they're leasing the space out to the retailers.
Right. So there's basically a subcontract out. And so they have none of the costs involved, none of the staffing, and they get free revenue basically off the top. And so another example of this is with Restoration Hardware. What they're trying to do with entities like Marriott and Hilton is say, look, we'll fixture your lobbies and your common areas with our furnishings, and you don't have to do that anymore. You can get rid of that cost, which is as much as 5-7% of their operating costs per year. And we'll put QSR codes on the thing, so if someone's sitting in a chair they like or a lamp and they want to know about it, they can scan it and look it up or order it while they're there in the hotel. And so the hotels get rid of a cost, furniture, fixture, and equipment, and the retailer gets direct kind of free showroom space to the types of patrons that would buy their stuff. So
interesting.
We see it's a win-win for both hotel. They offload an expense, pick up a revenue, and retail, they cut physical occupancy costs, and they can more directly target their consumer audience.
So they do this in the lobby and other common areas is where Restoration Hardware would put their wares.
Right, and I think we're going to see it eventually morph into the actual hotel rooms where you get XYZ mattress firm demonstrating or providing mattresses, or, you know, I think eventually it'll go all the way into the hotel rooms, but right now it's just common areas.
So have a lot of hotels, you're talking, it must be that a lot of hotels have actually retrofitted to accommodate retail, or is it strictly new construction where they're doing this?
No, so most of it right now is new construction, so the new brands, the new concepts by Hilton and Marriott. But it's going so well, they're looking at where they go in and redo a good location or a good facility. They're looking at extending these partnerships or alliances with, you know, like a Restoration Hardware, or could be a Haverty's Next, Haverty's Furniture, or, you know, how to bring more retail in. Because most of the hotels really don't want to operate, except maybe Marriott a little bit. The food and beverage, it's not a real big profit margin, but you get someone like a Chick-fil-A or a casual dining entity that already has a restaurant and a kitchen nearby and in a full restaurant, they can easily, you know, pack all that into a catering type truck like Chick-fil-A does and operate in under, 500 to 1,000 square feet and have a limited breakfast and lunch type menu or late night menu. And
so room service as well, they would provide the room service? Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's very interesting. Now, there's also so much talk about the last mile fulfillment because online retailers, now we're back to online here for a minute, online retailers are trying to compete with the traditional retailers by saying, well, hey, we'll get it to you the same day, that instant gratification that so many consumers insist on, we'll get it to you the same day. So this last mile fulfillment has become a big deal. What is the prediction on that?
So a couple things here. So we'll go back. One of the myths that we start off with at the beginning of the report is that online retail is expanding because it's more cost-effective, it's more profitable, and actually the data shows it's not. So most of the data we have is on, you know, the online apparel because it's been around the longest. And what we find is that the profit margin for online is the worst of all the options. And as you do online in-store or online pickup, your margins drop from, say, 30 to 32% down to, like, 12 to 20%. So, and part of this makes sense, the technology involved in online, and then how do you do the last mile delivery. The Amazon model with buying a bunch of Mercedes vans and going to your house sure isn't working out very profitably for them. So you have entities like Walmart that are experimenting more with in-store pickup. So you do order online, and we did that this weekend for a toy for my son, and it was going to take too long on Amazon, and then we did the in-store pickup in Walmart, and we did it in 2 days, and it was real easy. Kroger, on the grocery side, is looking at partnering with Walgreens, where what they do is say, you know, we're going to do online grocery where there's a heavy concentration of Walgreens stores, and we'll make your online grocery order be available at your neighborhood Walgreens. So you don't have to worry about it spoiling on your front porch or someone taking it or a squirrel getting into it or something. And so everybody's trying different models because they've got to figure out how to make it cost effective. Because right now it's not. Everybody loves the growth. If you read the retailers' earnings reports or 10-Qs, we got a bunch of those coming out here in a few weeks, what they'll all show you is Walmart or Target or Home Depot, you know, they're experiencing 20 to 30% year-over-year growth in online sales, but the profit margin isn't so good. So that's the big issue. Everybody knows that you've sold the millennials and maybe even some baby boomers on the convenience of online, and we're not going back, but how do we make it profitable? And so different models are going to be tried. Some will mean that for existing physical retail, you'll have to figure out how to make pickup, in-store pickup or drive-through pickup more effective. So what does that mean if you have, say, a Walmart or a grocery-anchored center, a shopping center? They're not set up to do, you know, drive-through and pickup. So how do you reconfigure that? What does that do to parking ratios and configurations? we've just begun to scratch the surface on what all that means for retail and retail investors. We haven't sorted it out yet.
So you do say that changes are needed in infrastructure and logistics combined with innovation like autonomous trucks and new warehouse designs. Now, autonomous trucks, everybody understands that. They're not really here yet, but quick advances being made. What about new warehouse designs, and how would that, well, what kind of changes are you thinking in terms of there?
Yes, let me go back and I'll push back a little bit. So autonomous trucking actually is here. I'll give you two examples. So Walmart today launches each night a fleet of autonomous trucks that move across the horizontal interstates between about 11 o'clock at night and 5 in the morning. UPS is experimenting with it right now between Dallas and Phoenix, and this will blow your mind. The state of Florida passed legislation this summer that will authorize autonomous trucking statewide in Florida on every state, U.S., and federal highway by January 1 of next year. They've dealt with all the technology, the insurance, the liability, all of that's done. So I think the autonomous trucking is here a lot quicker than most people realize. But
Is there a driver on board, or is it truly there's nobody on it?
No, it's nobody's on it. So the ones at Walmart do right now, they're chaperoned. They might have as many as 7 trucks. And they'll be chaperoned front and back by a little escort vehicle. It could be a minivan or a smaller type vehicle. And so they can take over and take controls. But they're running fully autonomous, and they're running on compressed natural gas rather than diesel. And so they don't even stop in your state to refuel. So what does that mean for truck centers? So and the ones in Florida, what they're talking about is something similar to an air traffic control system for air travel. So when an autonomous truck is launched next year in Florida, they'll register that launch of that truck with a control center where there will be a traffic truck autonomous truck control center that will co-pilot that truck from when it departs to its final destination, and they may follow 10 or 15 or 20 trucks at any one point in time, just like an air traffic controller might handle, 3 or 4 aircraft. So it's a model that's set up to emulate the air traffic control system, but with autonomous trucks on the ground. Pretty cool.
Yeah, amazing. Really amazing.
But on the warehouse design, what we're seeing is it's kind of interesting. So, the big box concept was originated by two retailers that aren't with us anymore, Montgomery Ward's and Sears, coming out of the 1930s and the Great Depression. They actually created the vertical warehouse distribution centers. Sears, you look at a lot of the old 1921s that have now been converted, like in Atlanta or Memphis, into kind of mixed-use developments. We're seeing that vertical supply chain and warehousing come back for two reasons. One, to do the type of autonomous trucking and e-commerce fulfillment, your land requirements have grown from a land-to-building ratio of, say, 3 or 4 to 1 to try 7 to 1. So you've just doubled your land need and your land cost in markets like a New York, a Miami, a San Francisco, and L.A., and that's just not feasible. So what we're seeing is the new designs, which are going vertical. There's one under development in New York in the Red Hook area of the Bronx where they're going vertical. It involves the Goldman Sachs Asset Management funding. They're doing the equity funding. It's a joint venture with DH Property Holdings, and it's a vertical e-commerce warehouse. And so it's multi-story, and what it does is it allows the trucks to move up ramps on the side of the building to go to their designated warehouse on whatever floor. It allows all the truck trailer pads to be stored underneath. And they're able to do e-commerce fulfillment on a land-to-building ratio of about 3 to 1. There's a similar one being developed in Seattle right now, which Amazon's involved with. Amazon will be the top floor. Home Depot will be the second floor. I don't think they've announced the third floor. But my theory is, of course, Amazon will always be on the top floor so they can spy on what's going on below them. But it's really interesting, the cost of land, the availability of land, and to get that e-commerce close to the dense population centers means a whole new type design. And we're going to go vertical in warehouses rather than expand out horizontal.
Wow, interesting. Okay, so Prediction number four, adaptive reuse of retail centers and malls will be the most impactful trend for retail between now and 2025. Elaborate on that, Casey.
Yeah, so this is a real serious one. So we wrote a paper about a year ago. We published one of our insights paper with the CTIM Institute in our real estate center at Alabama on adaptive reuse, because believe it or not, until a year ago when we did this paper, no one had defined it really. Nobody had quantified it. Nobody had looked at what are the obstacles and challenges and why is it happening. And so we identified that adaptive reuse activity right now is actually greater than all of the self-storage properties in the country. So, it's a pretty big property type by itself. And what's driving it is we have this huge supply of retail that's going dark. Could be a mall, could be a department store, could be a big box. So we have this huge supply going dark, and it presents two challenges. One, it's kind of a blight. What do we do with it? It's not great to have all these empty stores around. Number two, it presents a tremendous local government issue. That local government issue is that about 60% of local government revenue comes from property taxes. And the biggest balancing source of that is commercial real estate. So if residential doesn't pay enough property taxes to pay for all the services it sucks up in schools and infrastructure, so you need commercial. So a typical big box retailer and department store has paid in the past the equivalent of property taxes equivalent to somewhere between 100 and 200 homes, kind of depending on the density and the price of those homes. So if you don't do something with these empty stores and get them back to productive use and their value drops and what they pay in taxes drops, you're looking at a very serious local government funding shortfall in the next few years. And so we think adaptive reuse is the way out of that. The problem is local government doesn't know what adaptive reuse is. You know, it's kind of like the old adage, you know, what's pornography? Well, I'll tell you what it is when I see it. You know, what's adaptive reuse? I'll tell you when I see it. Most local government zoners and planning and design folks never took a course on adaptive reuse. It never existed when they went through, undergrad and graduate school. So they don't know what's involved, and there's a lot of issues relating to just the density. So a lot of older retail was built covering more of the site. There's setback ordinances. You go back and look at older properties, they don't have the same setback requirements. They may have antiquated parking requirements where we don't need it the same degree that we did. So what do you adapt, what do you adjust? We covered all that in our paper a year ago. But if local government doesn't get serious and work with developers on how to put these empty retail assets back to productive use, the fiscal wrinkle for them is they've got a local government funding crisis coming. And I think for the real estate development community, rather than looking at tons of new construction, what do we do around existing assets to repurpose them, to align them with services? And I'll give you two really good examples. So in Nashville, a few years ago, there was a mall called 100 Oaks Mall, great in-town Nashville market, and the mall had pretty much died, lost its anchors. So Vanderbilt Health System bought it. They needed expansion, and they converted this mall into mixed use with multifamily housing for the residents going through the medical school. They added medical office. They kept some retail, restaurants. They created medical offices for doctors. And it became very successful. So it's called 100 Oaks Mall. You can go into Nashville and look it up. Second one is I serve on the board of directors for a company known as Monmouth. We're a public industrial REIT, and we're one of the main landlords for FedEx in all their e-commerce and logistics warehouses. We own them and are their landlord in about 10% of all of their assets. And a few years ago, Monmouth had the opportunity to become involved with a mall in Mesquite, Texas. And this mall had failed, and they worked with a developer in FedEx, and FedEx converted the entire mall into a fulfillment center. And so they both take returns and they do fulfillment. And so here was a mall that actually became a solution to last-mile delivery. We're seeing just tons of examples of this in process, but I think adaptive reuse is one of the key solutions to putting these empty big box and department stores and dead malls back to a productive use, creating an investment opportunity for developers. And what we're finding is the economics are favorable to it. So So we're now collecting, we're about the largest database in the country, and we're collecting the financials on all of these adaptive use projects. And what we're finding is, as long as you don't have a big environmental problem, so you weren't on an old steel plant or manufacturing site, that the turnkey cost to take a mall or a big box or department store and repurpose it into a new use is about 15% less than ground-up new construction. And so when you look at these rising construction costs, there's a real compelling economic argument to look at adaptive reuse.
Prediction number five, property tax is a sleeper issue in retail that will get more litigious by 2025. What's going on there?
Yeah, so this is piggybacking off of some of what I just shared with you, is that, you know, when you look at the volume of retail that is going dark or closing, so this year we've already announced over 10,000 store closings. We may break the all-time record. So 2017 was the all-time record, a little over 8,000. So 2017 to 2019, we'll have closed over 20,000 stores. We have, you know, somewhere between 80 and 100,000 anchored shopping centers in the country, several billion square feet. And our prediction is that we're going to see us go from 24 square feet per man, woman, child, dog, cat, gopher, goldfish in America, more than anybody in the world, to something like half of that. So that means that we're going to see a lot more store closings and this stuff happen. So when a retailer closes, you know, a Walmart goes out, or, you know, a Lowe's, you know, or a Macy's or Sears, whoever owns that goes in and appeals the property taxes, because a closed Sears store isn't worth what it was when it was an operating viable store. And so the property taxes get reduced. That creates a funding shortfall that the local government has to deal with. And they either get that asset put back to use, or their alternative is they're going to have to raise residential property taxes by probably 20-25% in the coming years. So I think this is the sleeper issue out there. It's not just that it's unfortunate to see an empty shopping center or empty department store, but there's a real revenue consequence to local government. And it isn't solved by online retail sales tax, because the collection of those taxes go to the state budget level, and they don't trickle down to the same density or amount to the local government. So local government, their solution is putting these assets back to productive use to get those property taxes back up.
Now, the report also debunks a few things. Let's just take one of them, the real culprit behind retail bankruptcies. What is the myth about what's causing retail bankruptcies, and what have you found to be the actual cause of it, or causes?
Yeah, and this was, you know, kind of a surprising thing, because, you know, you start off and you have your hypothesis, and of course everybody assumes that, you know, with the growth and advent of Amazon, from books to retail to groceries and everything else, that it must have been Amazon and online retail sales that's caused all these store closings and bankruptcies. And we found, in fact, that's not the case. Most of what we've seen to date in retail bankruptcies and store closings is due to the over-leverage by those retailers. And the seeds of this go back to the 1980s, when we did this activity called leverage buyouts, and companies like KKR said, hey, retail's a great growth industry. We can buy and merge these and leverage them to the hilt, because they're growing so fast they can pay much more debt down the road. And so that worked as long as retail was booming in the 80s and in early to mid-90s. But then, you know, we started to see the creation of this thing called Amazon, and then we saw the Great Recession, and we saw that retail no longer was this great growth industry from adding stores and seeing physical retail sales grow. So when you look at whether it's a, you know, a Barney's in New York right now, or look at a Forever 21, or the two examples I like to use of a good contrast are Barnes & Noble and Toys R Us. So what in the world is a Barnes & Noble bookseller still doing in existence after what Amazon did to Borders and the bookselling industry? And the answer is Barnes & Noble didn't leverage up. They didn't have a lot of debt, and that enabled them to buy time to kind of figure out what was going on, reinvent themselves, add services. You know, you go into a Barnes & Noble today, and you've got a Starbucks or a coffee house, and you know, you have all kind. You have office supply store going on in there. You've got co-working in some of these stores now, and they just were acquired by a private equity group that also owns the successful bookseller over in London, mm-hmm. and so they bought themselves time. They didn't have a load of debt and senior debt holders to say, squeeze out the junior debt holders and just give me my money back because I have no more faith in retail. Contrast that with Toys R Us. Toys R Us was leveraged to the hilt. The senior debt holders said, man, we just don't love retail anymore. We don't see an out here. Walmart's going to crush Toys R Us with toy sales. Give us our money. Put them in bankruptcy. They're out of business. So all that Toys R Us has left was the giraffe and their name, and they're trying to come back with less than a half dozen stores and in like a 5,000 to 10,000 square foot footprint versus a 40,000 one. So there's a real good living example of where leverage absolutely killed, over-leverage killed Toys R Us, and the absence of leverage enabled Barnes & Noble to continue to survive. So we think everything we've seen to date, this really has almost very little to do with Amazon and online retail sales. Going forward, though, the growth in online sales and the behemoth of Amazon, which is now almost a $1 trillion company, versus it was about $5 billion in late 1990s before it started taking over everything, that will be much more pronounced. So going forward, when you look at how many retailers we still have with an over-leveraged problem, combined with the growth now of online retail, this is a pretty dire outlook for physical retail going forward.
Our guest has been Casey Conway. He is chief economist at the CCIM Institute, a commercial real estate organization. By the way, Casey's been touching on this report, but you can go to the CCIM.com website and access the full report. There's a lot more information there, but I have to tell you, Casey, this discussion has been really content rich. I mean, both the data and data-wise and conceptually, very, very content rich. Very interesting information you've imparted to us. Thanks very much for taking the time and coming on the program.
Well, thank you for the interest, and if we can ever answer any questions or help, we appreciate it. And I'm so appreciative. We've got industry organizations and outlets like yourselves that kind of are taking a look at these topical things right now and digging beneath the surface to find out what's really going on and maybe where we go. So thank you so much for the interest.